Guy reads so you can listen. This is the Crypto Economy Podcast. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is the Crypto Economy, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are doing some Bitcoin reading today. Nick Bhatia just recently dropped a new article, and as soon as I got into it, I was like, oh, this is going to be on the show. So, and it's not even that long. It's a really good one. So we are going to jump right into it. It is titled The Triumvirate of Liquidity. It's actually posted on the Tantra Labs or the Tantra Labs Medium page, but I will have all of those links in the show notes. And without further ado, let's jump into Nick Bhatia's article, The Triumvirate of Liquidity. Bitcoin is both digital gold and digital treasuries and has all the markings of the world's next risk-free asset. Introduction. U.S. treasuries, gold, and Bitcoin serve as a triumvirate of global liquidity, a powerful trio of safe haven assets that shelter their owners from the risks of our highly leveraged, credit-based monetary system. Of the $300-plus trillion in financial assets around the world, only $32 trillion exist at this echelon of safety and liquidity. Bitcoin captured an astonishing 1% of the trio's total market value after only 8 years in existence. Yet this was only a glimpse of the future. In its next chapter, Bitcoin will catapult toward gold's $9 trillion size, fulfilling its destiny as digital gold. After that, Bitcoin will morph into digital treasuries and replace them as the world's risk-free asset before eventually achieving world reserve currency status. Replacing the dollar as the world reserve currency is a lofty ambition, but it will occur only as a byproduct of Bitcoin embodying digital treasuries. Gold was the dollar's source of legitimacy. Gold is the original liquid global asset, a millennia-old money. The U.S. dollar's gold backing during the 20th century earned it legitimacy, culminating in the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement, in which the world's leaders assigned the dollar as the world reserve currency. Even though gold no longer officially anchors global finance, central banks still hoard it as the world's safe haven asset, presumably as insurance against a dollar system failure. Today, global central bank gold holdings exceed $1 trillion. Dollars meet euro dollars. In the 1950s, a new form of dollar emerged in Europe called the euro dollar, a book entry dollar to facilitate interbank settlement outside of the United States and outside the Federal Reserve banking system. As Eurodollar usage popularized, banks in London, Zurich, Montreal, and Tokyo gained the power to create this international settlement currency away from any regulatory purview. By 1971, excessive dollar redemptions for gold had depleted the United States reserves. In order to protect its holdings of the world's safe haven asset, the U.S. ceased all dollar-to-gold conversions, and the dollar officially lost backing. It still, however, had the confidence of global financial participants as their ultimate unit of account. Treasuries, not dollars. Dollars weren't backed by risk-free assets anymore, so how did investors store dollar reserves safely? Bank deposits are essentially loans to banks and come with an inordinate amount of counterparty risk. Withdrawing truckloads of $100 bills isn't feasible either, nor does it come with convertibility to an underlying asset. Deposits and cash simply aren't palatable investments for the risk-averse. The solution and capital market tendency is to purchase U.S. treasuries, a $23 trillion market, in order to safely store dollars. The dollar loses its identity. From 1971 to 2007, banks took complete control of the dollar, obfuscated its identity, and built an inherently unstable financial system on top of it. Eurodollars grew both in supply and sophistication. Banks stopped funding themselves with deposits. Instead, they used U.S. treasuries as collateral to borrow book entry dollars from each other. A bank license and U.S. treasuries together wielded the power to create seemingly unlimited money, obscuring money's very definition. The dollar lost all of the identity it once had as a gold claim and became purely a banking liability, a loan to the overly leveraged financial system. Instead of dollars, treasuries became the most desirable global asset, not only because of the U.S. government's counterparty superiority, but also because treasuries possessed omnipotent collateral powers that enabled money creation. Banks use U.S. treasuries, not dollars, as their risk-free asset, collateral anchor, and primary leverage vehicle. The dollar system breaks in 2007. In 2007, banks began facing funding pressure. The previous culture of strike-of-the-pen collateralized lending withered away, and banks were unable to roll forward their maturing debt. Banks relied on their ability to constantly issue new debt, and when confidence in them faltered, so did solvency. For decades, the relationship between dollars and eurodollars existed without much drama. Federal funds and LIBOR, the interest rate of each dollar type, mostly mirrored each other. In August 2007, however, LIBOR drifted higher relative to the federal funds rate, a sign of acute credit risk in the eurodollar system. In hindsight, the problem wasn't acute. Banks began pulling back from each other as the global dollar system had reached an inflection point. This interest rate divergence foreshadowed the subsequent cascade of dollar funding shortfalls and bank collapses. The multi-decade free run of money creation had cracked irrevocably. In 2008, the Federal Reserve bailed out the world by liquefying the entire system. It chose not to discriminate between dollar liabilities and eurodollar liabilities, and provided a lifeline to any bank or central bank in need by injecting reserves onshore and providing currency swaps offshore. Demand for the safety and liquidity of U.S. treasuries skyrocketed as they became the world's security blanket, trapping the world in a dollar denomination, even though the dollar's long-term viability as world reserve currency was irrefutably in question. Permanent disrepair. The financial system is infected with a chronic disease that won't go away. The dollar is no longer solely the national currency for the United States issued by the Federal Reserve. Instead, the dollar is an international banking instrument without limits, form, or the ability to sustain itself. The system decays as contractions in interbank liabilities cause repeated liquidity shortages for leveraged asset holders. Banks choose not to provide collateralized liquidity to other banks, even when the collateral is treasuries themselves. This is the ultimate warning sign that banks don't trust each other anymore. Furthermore, the Federal Reserve always bails out the system as the lender of last resort, permanently eliminating any motivation whatsoever for banks to provide liquidity to each other. The Fed's default response is to create U.S. dollar bank reserves, but this does not address the core problem of broken interbank trust. The Fed only provides a numbing mechanism, keeping the dying patient alive as long as they can. Bitcoin is digital gold and digital treasuries. What's the end game? Bitcoin is. Its software is engraved with Chancellor on the brink of second bailout to proclaim an elegant solution to our banking system nightmare. Bitcoin is a bearer asset like gold, a risk-free asset like treasuries, and a currency denomination like the dollar, rising up in parallel over the next couple decades as the infrastructure for the next financial system. Gold and Bitcoin are both scarce assets without counterparty risk, yet Bitcoin's digital final settlement functionality gives it a massive advantage over gold in the coming decades. Bitcoin is not only digital gold, though. It's also digital treasuries. Bitcoin is the safe haven from all other digital assets, just as treasuries are the safe haven from all other dollar assets. Bitcoin is used as collateral for derivatives agreements, just like treasuries are. But Bitcoin doesn't have the counterparty risk or supply variability of treasuries, positioning it perfectly for the forthcoming competition. Bitcoin is the risk-free asset of the future. The anti-Bretton Woods. The Bretton Woods monetary system established the dollar as the world reserve currency in 1944, but the next monetary system will not be determined by agreement between nations. Bitcoin's path to world reserve currency status will occur one asset holder at a time. Thanks to the early-stage Lightning Network, Bitcoin's design now includes an instantly settling currency function in addition to its slower asset function, a characteristic neither treasuries nor gold possess. But Bitcoin first needs to add many trillions in market value to truly compete with treasuries and gold as an asset class. Uncertainty demands liquidity. Investors demand risk-free assets when they face geopolitical and economic uncertainty. Securing the liquidity of these assets is paramount when other asset classes experience the brutal combination of increased performance risk and liquidity deterioration that is so common in today's financial world. In this era of dollar system fragility, the triumvirate of liquidity will reign supreme. Investors will scramble for financial safety, causing intense and persistent demand for U.S. treasuries, gold, and Bitcoin. Start here and here, links provided for a dive down the Eurodollar rabbit hole. Written by Nick Bhatia. All right, let's take a quick break and dive into Bitcoin as the world reserve safe haven asset. So this is one of those pieces that just gets my brain racing about all the different things and elements you can do with the Lightning Network because of what the Lightning Network represents. They're non-custodial liquidity networks. Like that's the network that's being built with this thing. So when he talks about in this article how he goes into, this is pretty dense. He's crammed a lot of history in here, and I know a lot of this is probably confusing. And even myself, I know there are a lot of things in here that I only kind of vaguely know. Kind of wish I had Nick here to actually answer some questions, but I can explain a little bit of it. But he talks about how banks don't trust each other, so they're not lending to each other. And a couple of weeks ago, we actually talked about this on the Raleigh Bitcoin Meetup podcast about the, which episode was that? I think it was World War B, maybe? I think that's right. But a friend of ours who comes to the meetup and knows seemingly everything about how the Fed injects capital, how the interest rate is set and then also manipulated, the difference between, you know, LIBOR and the Fed's funds rates, the role that treasuries play in all this. I mean, he's a wonderful resource, and I kind of had tried to get him on the show. I'm not sure how interested he is about that, but maybe that'll still happen. I'd love to just pick his brain for like an hour and a half. So back to how the Lightning Network plays into all of this is that like particularly when we're talking about a situation where banks don't trust each other and they have to provide liquidity for each other's markets, and to offer up like to create like a relationship with them. And because they're so over leveraged, the banks can't trust each other. And that's the perfect environment for some sort of non-custodial live contract with proof of reserves between those banks. That's actually why I think the Lightning Network's dominant use is actually going to be in very large agreements. Like I think after we get through the static backups phase of all of this, these will be unbelievable liquidity channels that will actually build capital markets. And then think about when you have a situation where you don't really have to worry about banks going offline in a situation like that, right? Like if how often does the New York Fed, you know, not have an accessible computer? It's just, that's not really an issue with these things. These are huge institutions that have been, you know, that are critical parts of the financial system. If they went down for an hour, people would freak out, right? So they have a lot of backups and all of this stuff in place. Now imagine that these institutions that are moving massive amounts of capital between each other can actually set up something like a channel factory where everyone has put liquidity into this joint agreement with the explicit stated goal. And again, this wouldn't be a situation like we have now with the Fed and the Fed banks. We were talking about a situation where a massive amount of capital is put up between banks who otherwise wouldn't be able to trust each other. So these are competing banks that have a lending market between them. And to have something like a channel factory, which is a technology that allows them to basically create a joint account, where any normal Lightning channel right now is just between, for the example of me, it's me and the other person that I am connecting to. And we can just keep adjusting back and forth within that one channel, and the channel itself only has our two keys. Well, there's this technology called Channel Factories. I've talked about it a number of different times on the show. I'll try to have a link to, I think I did a whole episode just about those, if I'm not mistaken. I'll do a little diving and see if I can find it. But Channel Factories are a way to do this with a group of people, and it's done in such a way where you have two of two off-chain channels with each of these parties separate, so that you can move your capital from one to the other off-chain. Because, like, rather than having a basic two of two at the foundation of this little tree of things that we got going on, we create a channel factory where the entire party has five signatures, and I have an individual channel that I open up after we create this five party agreement. Now I can open up channels with each of the four other people in this group, and I can close or rebalance or do whatever I want with those channels within our group of five people. However, I always have, because when we set up this agreement, just like any Lightning channel, a channel factory starts with the writing of the agreement to the exit, essentially. The ability for me as a service, a bank, a wallet, or just a user to exit the agreement with all of my money in its final state without the approval of any of the other four people, as long as I have the final state. Obviously, if I, you know, try to screw them, well, then they're going to execute the punishment clause. Again, all of this is set up at the very beginning. But that's an incredibly complex agreement, but that allows me and four other people, like a group of five people, to set up and manipulate liquidity between us. If I can know and trust that they're going to be online and available because they're a large banking institution, or they're a very popular service, or et cetera, that if I can know that they're going to be online, well, then we can constantly move all of this capital without ever having to question that the reserves are actually there. And that's what's breaking down the trust in these interbank networks and things, that there is no proof of reserve anywhere. It's all just based on the trust, and it's a liability built on top of a liability on top of a liability. Like it's layers upon layers of I don't even know if this is really worth anything anymore. And he talks about that, like, you know, this really started back in the 50s and 60s when it started to become clear that this was not going to be redeemed for gold. And then it came to a head during the 70s, the early 70s, 71 and 72, when the break with gold for the dollar was completely broken. And now the dollar doesn't mean anything. It's just a liability on an economy propped up by other liabilities. You know, the path that the dollar took to have its current network effect and its current psychological staying power for a safe haven asset, and how its entire legitimacy was based on gold, and then having that distance from gold and getting used to and comfortable with the actual dollar and the U.S. Treasury in place of that, that basically became the separation between what was actually backing it, what, like, the reserve, the actual value that was there. And now that we have, it's crazy to think that in a place where the dollar really did break, and you could argue in both situations, in the 1971 situation where it was just like, okay, well, we'll just hold it on essentially the promise that we'll have a relatively stable monetary policy, and because of the already built-in network effect of the dollar from the 30-odd years that it was actually backed by real value, well, then we will continue to extend that, and it will still be this safe haven. And then now, what we have, the exact same story has essentially played out again, where even though it was the dollar's fault, he's actually got a really good quote in here, because we did talk about this in the Raleigh Bitcoin meetup, and it seems so counterintuitive that it actually works this way, but it's one of those things that just shows you how powerful the network effect really is. So the section is it's toward the end of the whole breakdown in the 2007 and 2008 situation, and the difference, the interest rate divergence between the federal funds rate and LIBOR, that essentially it was showing the lack of liquidity and the breakdown of trust between banks, because liquidity was drying up and was forcing interest rates higher. Because, it's, you know, just think about it, like in a normal bid-ask situation, is if someone is requesting to take a loan and everybody else is already over-leveraged, well, then they keep having to adjust their interest rate in order to encourage people to, like, pull in money, to bring capital in. And that's why it was just a handful of weeks ago, maybe a month or so now, that overnight, the Fed funds rate, I think, is like 2% or something right now. I don't know. I don't really keep up much with it anymore because it seems so laughably stupid in the face of all this fantastically awesome things happening in Bitcoin. So somewhere around there, approaching zero indefinitely. It spiked up to like 6% and then 10% because the Federal Reserve was actually not able to introduce liquidity fast enough. So the interest rate just shot up in a matter of like an hour or two, showing exactly how extreme the lack of liquidity and the inability for banks to lend to each other, the distrust essentially that they had in the market, because obviously nobody's got any money. Like, none of this is backed by anything. The Federal Reserve had to jump in and basically offer all of this liquidity. And that's what he talks about in this piece. It's essentially the exact same thing that happened in 2008. They're just basically doing this as a stream of money constantly into the system now to try to just cover up the fact that since 2008, since, Jesus, I don't know, really since the late 90s, I don't even know how far back you really have to go, we've been over-leveraged this whole time, and we're so desperately in need of a correction, and they will not allow it to happen. because it will expose the whole facade. And the longer they continue to cover it up, you know, it's like, you know, trying not to come off of being drunk, like trying not to get into your hangover. So you keep drinking, or I don't know, you keep, you know, brushing trash underneath the rug or something. And at some point it just starts building up and you can't just lie and be like, oh, well, you know, we got a bumpy floor. They can't cover it up, but for so long. In 2008, this is the quote, the Federal Reserve bailed out the world by liquefying the entire system. Basically just offering up funds everywhere that people were not buying. Like, so when this liquidity broke down, the Federal Reserve is just like, all right, punch money into the bank account, and then we will be the liquidity that you can't find anywhere else because the entire economy's, or the entire financial system, is basically in the shitter. Quote, it chose not to discriminate between dollar liabilities and euro dollar liabilities and provided a lifeline to any bank or central bank in need by injecting reserves onshore and providing currency swaps offshore. And they did this for trillions and trillions of dollars. And in fact, that's what led to the investigation. Well, the inquiry that just turned into just, well, let's just brush this underneath the rug with all the other crap. About the fact that they actually lent, they created $9 trillion off balance sheet and made this available to a bunch of European banks and central banks. And so this isn't even, it's like, so when you look at like a chart of like, oh, the federal balance sheet is like, you know, $2 trillion or, you know, going up, or now it's going down a little bit. Understand that there is a mountain of money that they're just not even reporting. And like, that's, it's insane, the layers of obscurity that are covering up just utter fraud across the system. So many institutions are so deeply underwater that the Bitcoin will look so calm and reasonable in comparison to the amount of counterparty risk that is being, that will cascade through the system. And it may very well be, actually, Corey Clipson just talked about this on the Citizen Bitcoin podcast, and Saifedean has been talking about it as well, that we might just have a long, slow bleed, because the Federal Reserve really is a one-trick pony. You know, like, all it can do is offer up dollars, essentially, when they are demanded. Like, it's just a liquidity provider. So if the demand falls and we begin to get like credit defaults, or we start to get a collapse in the demand of the dollar, really, a lot of this money will start to disappear from the system, and it will cause deflation in the actual money supply, because so much of this money is actually just a liability that can't be paid back. So it will start to deflate the actual money supply, not necessarily price deflation. That may or may not be a result of it. That's kind of what everybody, the economic boogeyman here. And again, that's got nothing to do with price deflation with a sound money asset. It's a totally different phenomenon. And we talked about this too. Connor Brown just read a piece on this exact topic. Stop calling Bitcoin deflationary. Really good episode if you haven't touched on that one. And then also Deflation and Liberty. That was a two-part episode with a follow-up. Who wrote that one? Was that Hergito Holzman? That might be Holzman. I can't remember. I'll find the link. I can look it up really quick. I'm just lazy. Deflation and Liberty. Hergito Holzman. Yay, I'm right. Okay, I have a memory. So that is another really, really great piece to kind of dive into the nature of deflation as price deflation, that is, and then the separation between that and actual monetary deflation when the monetary supply is being cut, which is a consequence of credit crises, and that's not what Bitcoin does at all. Bitcoin is disinflationary, as Connor Brown explained in his piece. So I'll link to both of those as well. But it leads to the idea that there may actually be a slow trickle out of this. And that hyper-Bitcoinization may not need to happen with in conjunction with a complete and utter collapse of the U.S. dollar. And as we move to these safe haven assets, to which people will be desperate for, particularly like in a search for yield in the current and continually bad financial environments on a global scale, as they start to look for yield, they will seek to store money in gold, and Bitcoin will be added to the reserve assets. I just don't see. I mean, Nick Bhatia is right. Like the risk of not, in my opinion, is higher than the risk of doing it at this point. And its elements, the nature of how you can move it, and the ability to provide liquidity and proof of reserves. Just when we're talking about trust breaking down between massive financial institutions, the only question is there enough value held in the Bitcoin system to prop up these agreements, to prop up these relationships between these financial institutions? And that's really the issue. And if all of these banks have some degree of like mining capacity into the network, well, they have multiple layers of ways to mitigate those trust problems across national borders, across monetary policies, and backing up their value exchange, their own currencies, which could end up being where we end up at, in a place where gold and Bitcoin are simply backing the currencies that everybody thinks we're still using, very much like the... because we talked about this in the Bitcoin Times, Alexander Svetsky's. It's amazing how many little elements are coming together with what we've read recently, is that there's an infrastructure inversion taking place. And I think Bitcoin will take over the trust layer for interbank and international trade. But what we might end up with are largely looking like the same currencies that we've already been using, except with the too easy option in the realm of what the governments actually want to be available to us, because it kind of neuters their ability to control their populations, which is good, great, that's what we're after here. But the exit plan to get out to Bitcoin, therefore it forces competition in monetary policy to actually prop up all of these currencies that have been managed like utter garbage for so long. And undoubtedly there will be some that don't learn quick enough, and they will just feel the pain, and there will be some degree of very difficult and painful transition in this process. But Bitcoin is going to play an extraordinary role in this, because it can divide up and ensure trust among these institutions like no other asset that they've. I mean, gold. Even though you can hold gold personally, like you can have it yourself. But like even Germany, you know, they thought that they had gold. They thought they had gold at the Federal Reserve. And when they go calling up the Federal Reserve, it's like, can I get my gold now? They're like, nope. Like, look at the huge counterparty risk there, particularly between these large institutions. Why would they do business anymore? If Germany thought that they had all of this gold, I'm pretty sure it was Germany was the country. I'm just pulling that off the top of my head. So if I'm wrong there, I apologize. But, I know this has happened with multiple institutions, and so they have on their balance sheets like, oh, well, we own this much gold, but, you know, they didn't get it put into crates and shipped across the ocean and holding it in their possession, so they were always under counterparty risk, and they just got told no, so now they have to just, like, delete it. It's like, okay, we own dollars. We don't own gold, and none of this is backed by real value anymore. Like, so obviously, when things like that continue to happen, and when liabilities are backed by just freely printed capital, and liquidity is offered up by nothing, by just points on a screen, obviously trust is going to break down. Obviously, you're not going to have banks lending to each other, because why? Why would you do that when you have the Fed will just offer up liquidity whenever there's any question about whether or not you need it? It's really like a backdoor socialization of the entire financial system, that the only liquidity provider now is the central bank. And there's not even a market anymore between banks, because they would rather not. They were like, well, why don't I just get the new free points from the Federal Reserve that I can lend out? And my additional, my past liabilities will be paid off by the money injection that we have with the new liabilities that we create. And then everything will be good. We'll just keep rolling this until essentially the Federal Reserve is in charge of the entire balance sheet of the economy. They're the backbone of everything, and they're backed by nothing. And the whole thing is just so crazy. It's fascinating in the exact same sense that it's frightening to see all the elements in play that got us to where we are. And this is a really, really good breakdown. This really deserves like a 20-page expansion on this. And maybe Nick Bhatia will actually do this, because there's a lot of things that I know. I'm probably going to have to cut this off here. So, like, I know there's things that may be difficult to define. There's a rabbit hole just to chase some of the history and stuff he's talking about with the history of the U.S. dollar over, you know, the past 70, 100 years-ish that he's got crammed into this. But this is a really good breakdown and to show what role the U.S. treasuries, the actual dollar, like actual dollar liquidity, the fact that, you know, like to hold deposits, like these are liabilities between banks, so that's why you would switch to something like U.S. treasuries, and the fact that even though the dollar caused the essential breakdown of the global system, I mean, because dollar was a reserve asset, it's essentially reserve status got stronger because it still remained the only real safe haven. Its network effect was so strong that people latched onto it doubly hard. And then knowing that other people were going to do that, the demand just continued to skyrocket. It's such a crazy environment. There's so many things at play, and it's so nuanced. And like predicting how all of this is going to unfold is such a difficult task, if not really impossible, because there's just so much at play. And of course, so much of the system is just subjectively defined by, you know, the monetary priests and whether or not, I mean, if they made any substantial decisions to not provide liquidity, it changed the whole game. Because everything is backed by the fact, like the whole market between, like, interbank market is actually kept alive because there's a fake institution, there's a money just writing blank checks essentially to everybody, that's propping up everything when the actual market has nothing left to sort out, nothing left to distribute, and that's a terrible situation to be in. But here we are, and I think Nick has a really great point in this article that investors will scramble to find any safe place, any place external to all of these liabilities, something that does not have counterparty risk, that is a bearer instrument in and of itself, to hold on to for financial safety, because they can't find it anywhere else. Everything is so interconnected, all of our liabilities and problems, they're all dominoes that are stacked incredibly close together. You can't just hold one domino out towards the outside of the thing and think that your domino is safe, because they're all going to fall together. It's so interconnected that there's no safe place to put money. And right now, that persistent demand is going to land on U.S. treasuries, gold, and Bitcoin. And I think, just like Nick argues in this piece, and I think he's absolutely right, Bitcoin has one of the most prime positions in the ability to fulfill that role. It is digital in nature, which means it's easily proven. All you need to do is run a node on a computer, and you can know exactly what you have in relation to your, like, in relation to the entire monetary policy. It is easy to transfer. You can split up and write time lock contracts in the keys. You have such an array of ways to mitigate risks in holding it, in making agreements with others, with something like the Lightning Network, so that you can actually have a non-custodial relationship to move finances back and forth between other institutions, while you still hold your keys and the ability to execute a closure of the agreement that you can always remove yourself from the situation if you ever feel, you know, if you ever start to lose trust or you feel uncomfortable about the solvency or the reliability and the safety of the node that you're connected to or the business or service that you're connected to. And then also the ability to actually build. This is something that I've not seen talked about, and I know we got to close this one out here, but the idea of being able to attach to an agreement a certain number of mind blocks. And this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, is how would you move like $100 billion in Bitcoin between large banking institutions? And it's one of those things that, like, because we're talking about being able to trust another institution with a massive amount of money, and the Bitcoin blockchain does not, all of its security is cumulative, right? So, like, the amount of security that it offers is time dependent. It is based on a factor of time. So if you move $100 billion in three blocks, that shit is not safe. If you've made a, like, a real world exchange or some sort of agreement or something that is irreversible in the real world, and you only have three blocks deep on your 100 billion Bitcoin transaction, well, then you're in a situation where you are at risk, because it only costs like, what is it, like $600,000 or something to reverse that $100 billion transaction if they have the mining equipment. So you would want, you know, multiple, like 2 weeks of confirmations in order to reasonably consider your $100 billion transaction safe on the Bitcoin network, because you need that, you know, $50 billion force field around it to make it really stupid for them to try to reverse the transaction. And that is if they have an enormous amount of computing power. But you don't really know who has what. So I've been thinking about and brainstorming about how you can actually write into an agreement that, okay, I am going to produce 50 blocks myself and write this essentially into the agreement, saying that I'll take, like, maybe I can make a profit on this mining, maybe I can't, but I'm going to give you $100 billion, and then I'm going to prove that I mined over the next 7 weeks or something like that, I mined at least these 50 blocks or these 100 blocks, whatever portion of the network I think I have some basic ratio I can expect to get out of my large mining farm, because I'm a, you know, large financial institution, we're making a $100 billion agreement. Well, I'm going to specifically mine on the transaction that I am sending to you, and that is part of my agreement, so that you know it's safe, and that maybe the transaction doesn't even unlock or something until you get those 50 blocks or something like that. I don't know, that doesn't quite work because the other person is the owner. But you get the idea, like, to try to build trust in a transaction is that if that other institution, the one that sent the $100 billion, had any inclination to reverse it at all, if it was built into the agreement that they had to build 50 blocks on top of it, it would basically force them to have to undo their own blocks in order to reverse the transaction. So it's like a built-in, I'm guaranteeing this amount of force field that I specifically am going to make for this transaction. Now, I don't quite know how that would work out, but it's just an idea that I've been throwing around, and I think it would be a really interesting, it could possibly play a role in the future where mining is actually just a way to build trust in an agreement between very, very large institutions for very, very large transactions on Bitcoin to mitigate the very idea that any one of these institutions would ever reverse this transaction. You know, because the other party would basically say, I'm not signing the real world agreement, I'm not sending you your real world gold or whatever it is until you've mined these 50 blocks on top of this $100 billion transaction. So it's a really interesting dynamic, at least, that I think could play out in a way for mining to actually be incentivized, regardless of whether it was even at a minor loss. Because, you know, security is an incredibly high-paying, like, for lots of money, like the vaults, the ships, the armored cars, the amount of capital that goes into securing capital, a 1%, 5% loss on mining to establish security in a $100 billion agreement is not bad. You know, like you're still getting fresh Bitcoin, and if you're holding that for some period of time, you're not, it's not a total loss that, you know, you've added to the security, but you've been able to add security, maybe even, and think about if you're breaking even, you're basically like writing an enormous amount of security into the contract that you have with this other bank, and it's not even costing you anything other than time. I'm really inclined to think the more I toss this idea around that this could have a big, this could be a big play or a big part of large financial transactions on Bitcoin, because I feel like because the security is time-based, when we're talking about moving hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars on chain, I think that it's really important to take that factor of time into account because of the nature of the blockchain, that this security is a cumulative effect, and it is not I just send you a transaction and it's perfectly secure right now. It's I send you a transaction and it's secure based on the amount of cost in the force field in comparison to the cost of the transaction, the amount of the transaction. So anyway, and you already went way, way, way too far just in brainstorming on that. Yeah, this was an awesome piece. Another huge thank you. Nick Bhatia is always writing great stuff, and Tantra Labs. To be perfectly honest, I do not know. I have not checked out this blog and I'm not following them, so I am now. So I will have the show notes or the links in the show notes to both of those. Time value of BTC, that is Bhatia's tag on Twitter. And he was one of the very first guests we had on this show. I need to go back and listen to that. I have not listened to our chat in a long time. I will link to that one as well if anybody wants to listen to that. We had Nick Bhatia on the show and had a lot of fun with. Okay, it was the third chat. Nick Bhatia on the future of Bitcoin financial markets. I will link to that. That was a long time ago. That was like 170 episodes ago. Awesome. All right, so check those out. Don't forget to go to the article and drop some massive applause on the triumvirate of liquidity by Nick Bhatia. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to the show. That is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. This is the Audible of all things Bitcoin, where you will learn literally everything there is to know about Bitcoin. We read and talk about the game theory, the economics, the technology, the development, the history, the cypherpunks, the prerequisites, the cryptography, all the stuff that went into this fascinating, that has culminated into the birth of the Bitcoin system and then is expanding out from there into an ocean of new technologies. And just like the internet is going to create an entirely new ecosystem and a new stable foundation for a proper replacement to the mess that is our global financial system. So I cannot wait. I am so happy that you guys are taking this journey with me and learning about all of this stuff and love it as much as I do. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe to the show. Share it out with all of your friends in the Bitcoin crypto economy space and anybody who has money anywhere and doesn't want it to all vanish into thin air. Those are the people that this show is important to. Thank you, guys. And I'll catch you next time on the Crypto Economy. Take it easy, everybody.